Hey everybody, let me remind you one more time about my new blueprint for success. It's a project I've spent months and months working on just to help you jumpstart your comedy career and beat the competition. Whether you want to do stand-up, sketch, improv, acting, writing, producing, directing, radio, social media influencing, or even if you want a career behind the scenes as a manager or agent, Blueprint for Success will give you all the tools you need to take your career to the highest levels. With exclusive interviews, my top 50 commercial-free episodes from industry standard, one-on-one coaching with me, and unprecedented access into my knowledge and experience from over 40 years in this crazy business, I guarantee you that with Blueprint for Success, you'll become the creator you've always dreamed of becoming. No one's asking me to do this. I want to do it because I want to help you become truly undeniable. So just go to barrykatz.com, click on Blueprint for Success, and start your incredible journey today. I truly can't wait to work with you to help you change the trajectory of your comedy career forever.
You gotta like find that motivation as if you want to be a great artist. And it's like, yeah, because look at Spielberg or Scorsese, these guys, they have all the money in the world, but they still continue to make, or Nolan, for example, they still continue to make great work. And I think that that's the mindset you need. You know, mm-hmm. It's not about the money, it's not about the awards, it's about committing yourself to a process where you make the best film that you can possibly make, or the best special that you can possibly make, whatever it is.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Industry Standard with me, Barry Katz. I'm so excited to be talking to you. So many great things happening in 2023. Obviously in the world, not always a lot of great things happening, but in the entertainment business, sometimes the worst things that happen, the pandemic, both strikes, it appears like it's the worst of times, but as my mother always said, it's always darkest before the dawn, and things will get better, and things will be thriving again, and I feel that, and I'm grateful that you all are here, and that you listen, and that you enjoy this, and I just got back from Montreal, where I had an amazing time, and hung out with so many extraordinary artists, and so many of them came up to me and told me that this show was a big fabric of their lives and their development as comedians, and it meant a tremendous amount to me that when I started this crazy thing 10 years ago, that it actually has made a difference to some of you, and I'm, again, very, very grateful for that. But enough about that. If you need to reach me, you can do so at Barry Katz on Instagram or X, I haven't said that before, or at barrykatz.com. And without further ado, I'm really excited about this part one of this episode with two of the most extraordinary people I know, the Lucas brothers. So as I always do, I would like to introduce them properly before I bring them out, and you're going to need to get popcorn, and you're going to need to put this on double speed. All right. Comedians, actors, and writers, the Lucas brothers, Keith and Kenny Lucas, continue their rise as two of the freshest, most dynamic new faces on the comedy scene. Before the pandemic, their first stand-up special, The Lucas Brothers on Drugs, premiered on Netflix, and Paste Magazine, Complex, Uproxx, and Sidesplitter voted it as one of the top specials of 2017. They were also seen in the critically acclaimed season one of the hit Netflix series Lady Dynamite, starring fellow comic Maria Bamford. Additionally, they co-starred in the New Line produced feature film The Come Up with fellow comedians Jermaine Fowler and Lil Rel Howery. Throughout their careers, they were also seen in CNN's History of Comedy as well as HBO's Crashing, executive produced by Judd Apatow and created by Pete Holmes. Additionally, they also wrote TNT's NBA Awards, and they were the creators of the animated series one of my favorites, the Lucas Brothers Moving Company, which aired for 2 seasons. They also voiced the series' main characters, narrating hilarious, absurdist tales with, as the New York Times praised, quote, a disarming sweetness and a clever, stylized casualness, unquote. The Lucas Brothers also hosted the web series The Super Late Morning Show on ComedyCentral.com. Additionally, they starred in 2 seasons of the weekly sketch comedy series Friends of the People on True TV and were featured in the Fox primetime series The Grinder, starring Rob Lowe. Additionally, they also appeared in the blockbuster summer comedy feature film 22 Jump Street alongside Jonah Hill, Channing Tatum, and Ice Cube. You might remember they made their late-night television debut when they performed stand-up on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon in 2012 and have been a favorite of Fallon's Tonight Show ever since with multiple appearances. They are also familiar faces on Comedy Central with appearances on several network series including The Meltdown, The High Court with Doug Benson, and Adam Devine's House Party. They were named one of Variety's top 10 comics to watch and were featured in Rolling Stone magazine's Hot List, and appeared on the cult hit TV show Arrested Development, and HBO's Funny as Hell, and have been standouts at the prestigious Montreal Just for Laughs Festival on many occasions. And probably the thing they're most proud of is being a part of writing the story by and co-producers for the Academy Award-nominated film Judas and the Black Messiah for Best Original Screenplay. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome my guest today from Montreal. What an honor, the Lucas Brothers. I almost interviewed these guys about 5 years ago, but I failed miserably in the lobby of the Montreal Just for Laughs Festival. But thankfully, I succeeded with the help of their great management team, and it's really an honor to introduce them to you. Please welcome Keith and Kenny, the Lucas Brothers.
Thanks for having us.
Hello.
I have so many things to ask you guys, and I'm a little bit different than the normal interview because you have to listen to me at double speed.
Fair enough.
But you came in here firstly, and one of the things that always resonated me about a part of your stand-up was this funny bit you did about, I think it was Deion Sanders turning library cards into credit cards. Yeah. And the joke was, essentially the setup was, and the joke that you didn't really understand what he meant by that.
Right.
But I feel truly and more than anything in my heart that you guys have turned library cards into credit cards. You are two of the most incredibly brilliant people.
Man, thank you.
Look, my son Asher did his commencement address at his high school, which is a great accomplishment, right?
Definitely, absolutely. Okay?
One of the lines he said in his commencement speech, which is, I think, very factual. He said, I'm honored that I got asked to do the commencement speech, especially considering the last book I read cover to cover was Everybody Poops. And I think that's actually true. I can't get my son to read a book while you come in here and telling me you're up late reading about J. Edgar Hoover.
Yeah, I know. I don't know why.
We're dorks, man.
We're really dorks, man. We have this obsessive compulsion about, like, we just saw Oppenheimer.
Right.
And it blew my mind. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I got to find my next movie. And I think it's going to have to be about Hoover and Martin Luther King. But we'll see.
Yeah, because Christopher Nolan, he adapted the screenplay off of a book that won a Pulitzer Prize. And we're like, all right, maybe we need to read some Pulitzer Prize winning books to see if we can, figure out a story for our next film. But yeah, we're always reading, man. Always doing research. Always trying to find those footnotes to turn small stories into bigger stories. And
Because in the Hoover book, there's a footnote about William O'Neill. I was like, oh, we made a movie about William O'Neill. It's literally it's three sentences. So when I'm reading the book, I'm like, oh, there could be films
throughout the
book. And I think that's why I'm always reading, because I'm looking for ideas that I can adapt or that might motivate me to just write an original screenplay, like whatever it is.
Now, the audience might not know this, but in television, most shows are trying to hire
at least one writing team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they can get 2 for 1 because they make the same amount of money.
That's true.
As a single person.
Yep.
It's like one of the first comedy routines I ever saw in my life was this guy who passed away. His name was Rich Seisler.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes on with this sweater and he says, "I'm really excited today, everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I bought an extra large sweater." And people are looking at him like, what? He says, "You know why I'm excited? Because an extra large sweater cost exactly the same as a small sweater. I'm getting like 2 extra yards for my money." So,
that's funny.
So you write as a team. The only place you don't get paid as a team is acting.
Yeah, yeah.
And on camera, luckily, the Screen Actors Guild figured out a way to. But the point I'm trying to make is, so when you're doing your research, you also have the advantage of being, use economy. So right. You could read the J. Edgar Hoover book and do the Cliff Notes. He could read another book and give you that.
Right.
Do you do it that way, or do you both read the same book and both do the same thing and double up on everything?
Right.
It depends on the book. So we don't always read the same books. But like if it's like, for this J. Edgar Hoover one, I'm definitely going to read that one because I feel like it's something we could like transform into a film. So that same thing happened with the assassination of Fred Hampton. He was reading it first, and I hadn't picked it up yet. And I think you got like midway through,
right?
And he was like, "Yeah, you need to read this book." So then I'll start reading it. But it really just depends on the project and on the book, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I typically like reading what you read because mm-hmm. it's always fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
But if it's research for a book, if he comes across something and he's like, "You got to read this shit," I'm like, "Okay, I'll go read it."
Yeah.
But it's not like we're just like reading it at the same time, like trying to come up with shit. Like it's usually he'll find something or I'll find something and then we'll, you know, dive in together.
Right.
Tell me the last time you guys got in an argument where you didn't talk for at least an hour.
Man.
And what was the reason?
That's a great question. I mean, it used to happen more frequently before we started taking medication. So I take medication for bipolar disorder.
So I take medication for anxiety, depression, PTSD, ADHD.
So you're comedians.
So in other words, we're comedians.
Precisely.
The last time we got into an argument, I think, was Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
At the table?
No, it
not
was
at the table.
A few hours before, you were upset.
I used to get very grumpy and irritable when he would hang out with his girlfriend because I felt like she was taking time away from me and him, which is ridiculous, obviously. But
why is that ridiculous? When a naked woman is in the bed saying, "Come here, I've got my ankles in 2 different zip codes. Please come here, or go with your brother and write about J. Edgar Hoover."
That's precisely it, man. It's obviously ridiculous, and but I was being very stubborn, and I was like
that too for a very long time, just like jealous that he was entertaining the women or girls.
Yeah, we were just
girlfriend.
Very codependent.
Yeah.
You know, very codependent, and we didn't have any boundaries, and we had to learn all that stuff. We had to learn all that language. And so I finally learned that language, and now I give him all the space that he needs. But, yeah, during that time, I wasn't familiar with those terms, so I was just very irritable and upset.
So we argue, and then we stop talking to each other for a couple of hours.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then that's when I was like, "Keith, I think you need to go to group therapy."
Yeah, and I was like, "Fuck that, I don't need to go to group therapy." But then I eventually came to my senses. And
then you slept with a girl in group therapy.
And it was all dudes, though.
Right? Well, you know, it's a new world. So.
That's a good point.
And I just got canceled. So... I'm fascinated about how you get along and the dynamics between the both of you, because I don't know if the audience is, I'm sure they are. So I'm going to ask you some weird questions.
Go
so
for it.
Which one of you is the best socially with women?
He's significantly better than
I
am.
I would say I'm better for sure. It's only because... No, you're good. You know, you're really good with it. It's just that...
I've gotten better. Yeah. I've gotten better.
I'm just... I just go out more. You know, he's much more of an introvert. He doesn't really like going out to places and being around people. He kind of likes to stay to himself.
I'm reading about Jagger.
Yeah, he reads about Jagger Hoover. And so I'm responsible for going out there and, you know,
being one with the world. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not just like with girls, but it's like in general, just like
absolutely
trying to be like the person who's, you know, tries to, you know, talk to certain people and get things done on the personal side. But
he's a great communicator.
Yeah.
And I tend to be a little bit more extroverted,
which is good. It's actually a good dynamic. We can't have two people who are just like, oh, we're both social gadflies. It's like, I like the fact that, you know, if I'm out here going to premieres or whatever, I know he's in his place, you know, studying and writing and getting things going. So it's like we kind of balance each other out.
Who's the hardest worker of the two of you?
We both work very hard.
Yeah.
So if you were in a soundproof booth and you had to say one of you, would you say the same answer?
I would.
Yeah, I think we both work very hard. I think Kenny is, he works, he's a workhorse, so, you know, so I got to keep up with him.
Likewise.
But yeah, I think we both, like, we kind of push each other to work hard. We just have a very strong work ethic.
And we were super competitive in college, yeah, too, like with grades. Like, if he got a 4.0, I was like, okay, I got to get a 4.0.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's almost like that dynamic. When I see him doing super well, I feel inclined to want to work harder.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
we kind of learned that from our mom, you know. She wakes up every morning like 5 to go to work, and that's kind of like, it was instilled in us, like, if we wanted to get anything in this industry, we're going to have to work. You know, you have to work, got to put in the work. And yeah, I think that's why we push each other to work as hard as possible.
I remember when I interviewed Dr. Phil, and he came in and he was exhausted. I'm like, Phil, because I know him, I was like, you're a mess. Like, what's happening? You're like, you're so exhausted. Mm. And he said, I get up every morning at 5 and do press for my show. Mm. I said, you've been number one for 13 years straight, Phil. I don't understand. He said, I want to stay number one.
Mm.
And so,
right.
Do you work harder when things are going well, or do you work harder when things aren't going well?
Wow.
Man, that's a phenomenal question.
I'm good for one of you.
I want to say that we keep the same approach irrespective of, you know, where our careers are. You tend to work a little bit harder when you have less money in your bank account. But for us, it's like, you know, we made Judas, and we know that that's like a definitive part of our career, but we want to make sure we top that. So, you know, it's like we're working extra hard to make sure that we're not just known for Judas and the Black Messiah. We want to be known for multiple movies.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what pushes us. So I don't know.
I mean, we didn't win the Oscar.
Right.
You know, we were nominated. So right. For me, it's like there's still something else to strive for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's still like, I want to win.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say that I'd be a failure if I don't win, but it does. In my mind, it's like I have something to strive for.
Mm-hmm.
And so long as I have something to strive for, I'm going to keep working hard.
Right.
And if I do get the Oscar, then I'm going to have to push for the Nobel Peace Prize. And I'm just going to keep pushing myself.
You know, it's strange. Again, I don't know you guys as well as you know yourself. I don't even know you guys as well as the guy in the lobby who took your reservation. But I don't, just doing the research and seeing interviews and seeing how you do your comedy, I would never have guessed that you were awards driven. I felt that you're work driven, like you're just do great work.
For sure.
And if our peers, you know, think that we're great and our fans think we're great, whatever, when you said that about the Oscar or the Nobel Peace Prize, I never thought you had the aspirations of Bones, Thugs, and Harmony.
So here's the thing, like, I see what you're saying, and it's like, it's not so much awards driven. We want to make high quality work, right?
Right.
We want to make films that stand the test of time. And it's like the Oscar nomination or Oscar win is just a byproduct of making a great film.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, and if you don't get the nomination, it's fine. You still made a great film. But I think that we put that pressure on ourselves just so that we know, like, we're not taking any shortcuts, and we're going to try to make the best possible film that we can make. And
Because like we're delving into Freddie Prinze, his story, and we're like, okay, how do we make this film as majestic and as of its highest quality as possible? And it's like, well, you look at the past films that have reached a certain level.
I think you're going to be able to do a slightly better than I Can't Hear the Laughter,
which I watched recently, and it's terrible.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Terrible TV movie. Wow. Right.
Yeah, and it's so much in Freddie's story that just works cinematically. Mm-hmm. And when you read it, you're just like, why hasn't it happened yet? It needs to happen. And so you look at Boogie Nights, you look at Wolf of Wall Street, you mm-hmm. look at these films that you're building upon that language. And I think that that's why I'm always thinking about, like, if I had to vote for this movie to get an award, how would that, well, like, how would I structure the film mm-hmm. in that way? And if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. But, like, at least you're putting the film in its best possible light. That's all I care about.
Yeah, Freddie Prinze was a big influence on me, a teenager getting the Tonight Show.
Right.
You know, because when I was working with Chappelle, I think he did 45-minute television appearances before he was 20 years old.
Jesus.
But he has something in common with you, Dave. And some of the greatest years of my life, those 8 years that I worked with him, just incredible. But one of the things that always blew me away, because I was a white guy from Longmeadow, Massachusetts. Right. I wasn't really around women as much. I wasn't around drugs as much. Right. So when I met him, I was really stunned at how he was able to, like, you know, wake up at the crack of two, smoke a bag of weed mm-hmm. a day, and be a genius.
Yeah.
And I still don't know. I presume he's a better stand-up comedian and a better creator because of weed.
Mm.
I can only presume that because that's all I knew in the beginning when he broke through and was so phenomenal.
Right.
The red light went on and it was always magic. And there's a few people like that, some who are, if no one knew their personal lives or the story that comes with them, they would be some of the biggest stars. Like Andy Dick would mm-hmm. be one of the biggest stars ever, because mm-hmm. when the red light goes on, it's always magic.
Right.
But Dave was always that way. But so I'm asking you guys, like, obviously weed plays a very important part in your lives.
Sure. Yeah.
Do you think that if your career started without weed, that you'd be more successful, less successful, or exactly the same?
I don't know. I think especially early on in our careers, because of the anxiety and the inability to, like, really, like, think and have a clear mind, we play such a huge role.
And we had something to, you know, we weren't exactly sure what our voices were. So, you know, we was sort of like the first thing we could talk about that, you know, was a bit more personal. And I do think that when you smoke weed, it does, you do tap into something that creatively that you can't really do if you're not smoking. But we didn't want to use it as a crutch, you know what I mean? We didn't want that to be the defining trait of our career. It's like, oh, these guys are just these stoners. So
I think for stand-up and for our early sketch TV writing,
and the animated show.
TV. Oh, so, TV. And it was great to be stoned, but I think for filmmaking, you know, there's some filmmakers who smoke weed. Seth Rogen,
of course.
But for me, it's like, it's harder to sit down, write the script, pitch the script, produce the script. Like, if I'm stoned, like, I prefer not.
Shaka smokes all the time.
But
so the director of Judas is a huge stoner.
Everyone's different.
Yeah, everyone's different. It's like I still smoke weed, and I'm not as, I don't smoke it as much as I used to, but it still definitely helps in terms of my anxiety and my creative thinking. So I don't know where I would be without it. I do think that
it is amazing.
It has pushed me creatively for sure.
You just got me thinking about something. You said the director Shaka.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You said he smokes weed all the time.
He's a huge stoner.
This is something I've never asked any of this before. So when you're not high and you're just, I'll just call it sober. That's the wrong word. And you're walking onto a set, and you're taking that role or that writing position really seriously. Mm-hmm. You're getting up early, you show up early, you're mm-hmm. ready, and you walk on, and the guy stands next to you and talks to you, and it's like, you know, clearly he's been smoking since the crack of dawn. Do you feel anything like, this doesn't feel right, or I wish that he started the day a certain way, and at least so I feel like we're all on the same page, knowing that you've been at both places? Or does that not bother you?
Not with weed.
No.
Weed doesn't bother me. Not, now, if he was on set drunk or,
right.
you know, high on, like, heroin, then I'm like, all right, well, maybe we need to.
Yeah, it didn't, but weed, it didn't affect his performance. In fact, I do believe that it, for Shaka, like, it really... It's like it's medication for him at this point, and I think he used it to help make a brilliant film. So it's like, yeah, it's like whatever a person has to do to
not whatever,
but you know, if it's not too destructive, right. Weed has been found to.
I think weed is medicinal. Mm-hmm. I think there are hard drugs, and then there's weed. I would even classify. I think weed is different from. Alcohol
and cigarettes,
to an extent. So if a director or a producer or cinematographer, whomever, if they're on set and they're a little stoned or a lot of stoned, I'm not too bothered by it,
mm-hmm.
because I think it does have a medicinal quality to it. But if they're like f-ed up, drunk, and
yeah,
you know,
coked
or meth out, I don't care what you do. In the privacy of your own home, but if you're on set,
right,
f-ed up that way, then I know you're affecting the quality of the film.
Mm-hmm.
But we've all seen people
yeah.
who smoke weed who are not hardly conscious.
That is true.
Okay, so if you're, let's say you're writing a movie, let's say, and I don't know what your total role is on the Freddie Prinze movie. I don't know if you're just writing it or if you're going to be producing it or whatever.
We'll produce and write for
Great.
Sure.
Yeah. So you're producing and writing it. When you are making your votes for who's going to work on it, are you more likely to, you know, because it's your baby, it's everything.
Right.
And you hear somebody is, you know, let's say they smoke a ton of weed or they're just, they live a lifestyle that's a little bit more artisty
right.
than whatever. Are you more inclined to hire them because you're like, I get where they're coming from, or you're more because it's you're investing in your future.
Right.
You're more like, hey, let's take a beat on this and
yeah,
let's see.
That's a great question.
I mean, I can go back to the, you know, Fred Hampton film, and when we first met when we first pitched him the idea for. The Fred Hampton film, we were all smoking weed, you know what I mean? We were passing joints around,
sure.
talking about what this film could be. And that didn't deter us from, you know, wanting him to be, you know, the director to take this project to the next
and
level.
And then with Freddie, we're talking to Chris Mercado.
Yeah.
He smokes weed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm not bothered by it at all because he's so f-ing talented. Mm-hmm. Like, I know that in his hands... this idea becomes a masterpiece. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if he wants to smoke some weed, by all means.
Right. Right.
But I haven't seen anything in his lifestyle that makes me say, okay, I'm not going to put this in his hands because
right.
I don't trust that he'll get the job done. I do trust that he'll get the job done
mm-hmm.
because I've seen his work and I've seen how he works. And if he has to indulge some marijuana,
yeah, it's just like, you know, we feel like if a creative needs to smoke weed to tap into that space, you got to give them that space to do that. So as long as they get the job done, you know what I mean? Shaka got the job done and, you know, weed didn't stop him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a matter of just like finding the right partners who you feel can both handle smoking weed, but also
because filmmaking, it's a lot of pressure,
stressful, man.
Just dealing with the studios, dealing with the executives,
mm-hmm.
they're constantly like, you know, nitpicking every aspect of the process because it's their money. You know what I mean? So I get why they're so, you know, invested and sometimes what do you call it, micromanaging.
Yeah.
And the director has to, you know, balance out the work with the actors and. everyone on set, but also dealing with the studio. So they're right dab in the middle of everything. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes taking a hit from a vape or smoking a joint could help alleviate
ease
that
some
stuff.
Of the burden. So. Yeah.
Hey, everybody. I hope you're enjoying this episode as much as I am. If you made it this far and you haven't fallen asleep yet, then you must be the type of person who's serious about having a career in the comedy business. That's why I'm offering you my blueprint for success, a one-of-a-kind all-access pass into my knowledge and experience after over 40 years of working with the best of the best in this crazy entertainment industry. I'll tell you all the stories, all the philosophies, give you all the great special guests, and even give you one-on-one private consultations to help you expand, enhance, and skyrocket your comedy career. Just go to BarryKatz.com and click on Blueprint for Success to learn more about my groundbreaking digital academy that I've created just for you. With it, we can take your career so far that one day, instead of listening to this podcast, you'll be interviewed on it. Let's pretend that it's your money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's pretend the next project you're doing, I presume it's the Prinz movie is the next project.
That's what we're pushing for, yeah.
So let's presume that nobody's giving you any money, nobody's doing anything, but you have $1 million of your own money to make a low budget movie, but that you know you can make because of all your relationships.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I'm not going to say 10 million. I'm just going to say something realistic. So let's say you, let's just say you guys had $10 million in the bank and you're carving off $1 million to make this movie and you're going to pull every favor you can.
Right.
It's probably going to be like, you know, $500,000 for the actual physical production. And maybe you'll have some money for a star to do something, and who's going to play that role, who you got to get, who'll do it as a favor, and you'll condense the board, but it's your money. How close are your actions to the actions of the studio executives that nitpick you? What will you be, what will the both of you be like when it's your own money?
I imagine that, you know, you become a little bit more,
of course,
micromanaging. And
I mean, I like to believe that I won't do that. You know, obviously, if it's your money, you're probably going to be a bit more involved, but
critical.
I won't micromanage. You know what I mean?
Not micromanage, but I think you're going to want to know where your dollar's going.
Of course, of course.
You know, you're not just going to just burn money.
No. So that's why you got to make sure you make the right decisions of who you decide to.
But this begs the question: so do you hire a person who's might be a little bit slower with their decision making because they're under the influence, you know, like maybe you're like, you know, I know he's an artist, I know she's an artist, but
I'll look at their past work and talk to people who've worked with them before and see if, like, you know, they're,
because time is money.
Of course, absolutely. Right. But, you know, you can still look at a person's body of work and how they've worked with other people, and, you know, you get all that information before you make that decision.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I wouldn't completely rule off someone who just smokes weed. You know what I mean? I would try to do a little bit of research before.
But would you understand more of the studio? Like,
definitely.
Yeah.
I don't think that, look, and I don't want to say this too, because, you know, we're in a strike right now, and the studios are the, you know, they're the opposition at this point. But there was a moment when we all worked together. And it's going to be a moment when we get back to that. So it's like it's a partnership. I see the studio as our partners. I mean, they may not see us as their partners, but they're investing a lot of money,
right.
So they have every right to give notes and scrutinize and whatever.
But I think what becomes problematic is when you become too micromanaging and you're getting all those notes, you're slowing down the process
right.
You know what I mean? Like, you may think that the director who's smoking weed might be slowing down the process, but if you're an executive and you're just being like neurotic and you're noting to death everything, you're also slowing down the process. So I think that, like, hopefully when we get back to work, there's a recognition that, you know, not everything the executive does is right and not everything the creator does is wrong. Like, there's a balance, and I think the best partnerships, you know, you give the creative a little bit more leeway to do what they have to do. And I think the executive, and you give a little bit more respect to the executive mm-hmm. and what they have to do. Like, right. I think it's just like a mutually beneficial relationship. That's how it should be.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always that way. In theory, it should be that way, but it's not like that always.
Do you share your work with others and ask them to give their thoughts? Because I remember I interviewed Jeffrey Klarik and David Crane, who did episodes.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, you guys wrote every single episode. Did you ever do the table reads where you brought everybody around and your friends come in? Mm-hmm. And no. You had nobody even guess their opinion? No.
Mm.
Did August Wilson ask people's opinion? And so are you the type of writers that after you finish something, you give it to somebody and you say, hey, could you let us know what you think about this? Or
yeah, it's two schools of thought on that. Like, we've been working with Judd for like the last decade, and he loves to do table reads and he loves to share his work with others, and part of that sort of influenced us too. We were just like, if we want to know that the script is where we need it to be, then it probably helps to get other writers to read it, but writers that we trust,
mm-hmm.
that we know wouldn't share it to a bunch of other people. We have a lot of close friends who are writers who mm-hmm. who we trust, but it really depends on the project. Like, if it's a comedy,
yeah,
I think a table read makes a lot of sense. You want to feel that energy. You want to mm-hmm. see what jokes are hitting.
Yep.
But if it's a drama and it's something that we feel like really, really like close to, we'll keep it to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't share the Freddie Prinze script or our script about Dr. King until we
figured out the story mm-hmm. through and through, and we're confident that the story works. We won't share it. But with the comedy, we'll share it. We'll share the outline for comedies because mm-hmm. we want to know if it's funny.
One of the things I'm always fascinated about when I spoke to Adam McKay about this, Judd Apatow as well, who you work with, you know, when you end up doing your own project and there's roles or a role that's mm-hmm. really special, like award-worthy special role, and it's a role that's an age range that is in the vicinity of five great artists that you're friends with.
Mm-hmm.
But there's only one role that you make the decision on who gets that role.
Right.
No one else. How do you maintain friendships with the other four people when you choose one person who you know who are your friends to be involved in something?
That's a great question. You hope that, you know, your friends understand the dynamic of the dynamics of filmmaking, and that, you know, usually for me at least, and for Kenny, I'm sure, it's like the best person wins. You know,
Think about Nolan and Cillian Murphy and Batman. So Cillian, he good friends with Nolan. He auditioned for Batman, wanted to be Bruce Wayne, and Nolan was like, "Well, I don't think you're right for this role,
mm-hmm.
so I'm gonna go with." What's the guy's name? Christian Bale. Yes. He went with Christian Bale. They made three fantastic films, and Cillian
was a supporting
character, Scarecrow. And then now you get Oppenheimer and he finally says, okay, Cillian, this is the role you're right for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Nolan is such a great filmmaker that he's able to go to people who he genuinely likes
mm-hmm.
and say, well, I can't cast you for this. I'm sorry. I think you have to have that.
I think it's just being honest about the process and, you know, telling your friends or whomever, like, look, this is the person who's the best person for the job. But that doesn't necessarily preclude us from working on something in the future. You know what I mean? It's like, every project is very unique and special, and every filmmaker should have the
like Daniel
liberty.
Was perfect.
Yeah, Daniel was perfect.
There were plenty of people who wanted the role,
mm-hmm.
but it had to be Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
And it
just like
out.
It had to be Lakeith. You
right.
know what I mean, we went straight to Lakeith, and you kind of just know. You know what I mean when you're putting together. Or at least for us, when we write, we like to write with people in mind. You know what I mean. We like to write with actors and actresses in mind, just to. You know, help us like shape the character. And I think that's what Nolan does too. When he was writing Oppenheimer, he had Cillian Murphy in mind. So that's just, I mean, you gotta trust the filmmakers. You have to trust their process.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe that we're building up enough credibility where our friends trust our process.
That's one of the things that always bothers me about most filmmakers is that they don't give somebody the lead role, and they don't just say, hey, would you like to play transvestite hooker number four? You know, you got something for me, or right. whatever it is.
Right.
And they normally are afraid to ask the person to do a lesser role because they think it'll be insulting when instead it'd be something that'd be, I think, really, really important. The last point on this, has anybody ever, I presume there's been roles that you both auditioned for singularly.
Yeah.
How many times in your lifetime has one of you booked a role over the other?
It's never happened.
I don't think it's ever happened.
No.
We're a package deal.
Yeah.
So wait, you've never auditioned for something separate?
We've auditioned for something.
We just
separate.
Never get it.
Yeah. You know,
anybody ever gone forward with the next round and the other one didn't?
Never.
No, it's never happened. Surprisingly, yeah. Like, it's like, normally when he doesn't get something, I don't get it.
Right.
If we both get it, well, if he gets it, then we both get it.
And I think what hurts us, honestly, is that if we're auditioning for a singular role or something like that, I walk in, I give a so-so audition, and then he'll walk in.
It poisons
the well for him. And it's like they're watching the same actor do something terribly, and I think it hurts his chances.
I mean, it also, dude, we're not the greatest actors. So
no,
it's like,
we're not very good actors.
It's like, you know, we play ourselves.
Which one of you would you hire to do a singular role?
Oh,
who's
right,
the
him.
Best actor?
I think he's a better
actor. I'm a slightly better actor.
He's a better actor than me, for sure. I get too nervous, and I don't know. My eyes don't remain where they need to remain. I'm bad with eye movements, and
you're a decent actor.
I'm decent, but it's not my bread and butter. I'm blown away
that you said the word nervous, because it's the last thing in the world. I think I know what you're saying. You suffer from anxiety and bipolar. I got that, and that wasn't a general statement.
Right.
So, but I just don't see success and anxiety going together. I just don't see that happening, and you're successful, and then people love what you do, and you can feel, I can feel when I sit next to you, like something that a lot of people don't know about me, and I'm just really recalling at this moment, which is very strange, is that the first person I ever sat down to that worked on anything that had to do with a camera and scripted things. I was helping out a sketch group make a short, dark comedy film. Mm. And the director of that long ago was Darren Aronofsky.
Oh, wow.
And this is like the first time where I actually sat down with somebody since then. You know, I mean, I'm talking about where things are rising, where I actually get the same feeling in my heart of you guys growing into this point where you're making the most extraordinary content that people can watch out there in the world.
Right.
And it's weird that just came over me, because I hadn't thought about that in so long.
Yeah.
And so I just want you to know that there's something about you guys that's really, really, I mean, you know, there's something special. You obviously show me who you're with, and I'll show you who you are.
Right.
You know, you're working on, you know, you're working on an Academy nominated film. You spend 10 years working with Judd Apatow, one of the most amazing artists in terms of generosity and kindness. And if he believes in you, then it's like, you know, it's like you have wings. It's like he's like the Red Bull of people
in
the industry.
Yeah. It's true. It's once we started working with him, that's when things started to, we became better filmmakers. You know what I mean? Like he's very generous with his time.
Mm-hmm.
He mentors so many different other filmmakers, and it's just been a privilege for me, and I'm sure
without question,
just to be able to work with someone who has, you know, mastered the business in terms of filmmaking. But yeah, thanks for the kind words, man. That's like, you know, that's how we want to be perceived. And we hope to one day get to a point where we're just
we're like Darren Aronofsky. He is a genius. That guy's a genius, man.
Yeah, he's great.
I just watched Black Swan again. I was just like, how?
I love the rest of it too.
How did he come up with that? It's great.
Yeah, well, that's what people are thinking about you and are going to be thinking about you, because I think sometimes it's tough, because I think this is just, I'm only one person's opinion, but I think it's not as challenging, I think, to work on projects around regular human beings that are real life people as opposed to fictional things.
Right. Yep.
And I think if I were a betting man, I was going to say that your greatest gift to this world will be something that you do involving characters that haven't lived in this lifetime. Because you tend to spend time doing things about real characters in real life, including yourselves.
Right.
And I think that's more comfortable to you.
Sure.
And I think once you go to a place where you're not as comfortable, I think you're going to really, really find things.
I don't think you're wrong. I do. I think there is comfort in realism. I think when you're taking stories from history, you get a sense of the relationships, you get a sense of the characters. So it's not as much heavy lifting, I would say, right?
Yeah. I mean, you're trying to come up with an original idea compared to just, you know, talking about someone's life is definitely more challenging. But I mean, again, it depends on the story, right? Like,
right.
I feel like with Hampton, it's like you can't even believe most of the shit that happened. You know what I mean? It doesn't even feel real.
But then I think of Nolan. You know, he just does the biopic with Oppenheimer, and it's his, in my opinion, his best work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this is a man who made Inception and Interstellar.
But I think
Memento.
It's the other way around.
It's the other way around.
Like he needed to.
Yeah.
Talk about real people to push himself to
the next level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas we probably need to go the other way.
Right.
We're pushing ourselves to, you know.
Right. There's a comfort zone that you find yourself in.
And I really feel that way. Like, it's like, who am I to say that, you know? But I have no filter, and I want to say what I feel. And you're a great artist. And I, you know, sometimes artists, I always say to people who will listen without rolling their eyes, you know, who's a better trapeze artist? The one with the sold out show, they both do the triple somersault. One performs with a net, one performs without the net.
Right.
Who's the better artist? It's the one
without the net.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, because they know it's like it could be their last.
Right.
And I think it's something that you said that was fascinating about how, you know, well, we tend to work harder when we don't have much money in our bank.
I mean, it is what it is.
Right.
You know, it's like once you have more money, you got to like find that motivation as if you want to be a great artist. And it's like, yeah, because look at Spielberg or Scorsese, these guys, they have all the money in the world, but they still continue to make, or Nolan, for example, they still continue to make great work. And I think that's the mindset you need. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's not about the money. It's not about the awards. It's about committing yourself to a process where you make the best film that you can possibly make, or the best special that you can possibly make, whatever it is. And so I think that's where we're trying to get to now. You know what I mean? Before, when we first started, it was about survival.
Right.
But now it's just about like, yeah, doing our best work, you know, doing our best work.
As always, this has been Industry Standard with me, Barry Katz. And if you like the show, tell all your friends. And if you don't like the show, tell all your friends.
You get all the money, drive that fancy car. All the people love you, 'cause you're going far. Life is for the dreamers. They have all to gain. It's never quite over till it all feels the same. You pick your own poison, dig your own grave. Down in the valley.
Thank you for listening to Industry Standard with Barry Katz. If you'd like more info on our schedule of new episodes or how to reach Barry through Twitter, Facebook, or email, go to BarryKatz.com. Before you leave, please take a moment to subscribe to our podcast, leave a comment, and rate it, even if you think it blows. Thank you for your support, and have a great day.
Hey, everybody. Let me remind you one more time about my new blueprint for success. It's a project I've spent months and months working on just to help you jumpstart your comedy career and beat the competition. Whether you want to do stand-up, sketch, improv, acting, writing, producing, directing, radio, social media influencing, or even if you want a career behind the scenes as a manager or agent, Blueprint for Success will give you all the tools you need to take your career to the highest levels. With exclusive interviews, my top 50 commercial-free episodes from Industry Standard, one-on-one coaching with me, and unprecedented access into my knowledge and experience from over 40 years in this crazy business. I guarantee you that with Blueprint for Success, you'll become the creator you've always dreamed of becoming. No one's asking me to do this. I want to do it because I want to help you become truly undeniable. So just go to BarryKatz.com, click on Blueprint for Success, and start your incredible journey today. I truly can't wait to work with you to help you change the trajectory of your comedy career forever.